evening. Welcome to the Solari Report. Today is February 6th, 2014. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Upcoming events, we're working on putting together a lunch that is very exciting. It's going to be joint with Going Organic Magazine in Palm Springs, that's Southern California. And if it comes together, it'll be May 3rd, and we'll keep you posted on that. So if you're in Southern California, you may want to put a hold on lunch on that date. It's a Saturday. Our theme tonight is the spirit of offense. I was inspired. I used to listen to a wonderful sermon that Joyce Meyer did based on the scripture that says, in the last days, the spirit of offense will rise. And I listened to it, and the whole sermon was about how you could not give or take offense, no matter, you know, how sensitive the environment was. And I listened to it about 20 times, and I said, you know, I'm just going to keep listening to this until I cannot take or give offense, you know, in a fractious environment. And I made the mistake of lending it to somebody, never got it back. I'm sure if I hadn't given it away, I would still be trying to do it and listen. That comes to mind because I have been amazed just in the last month the extent to which the speed at which people take or give offense has risen, and the anger in the environment is going up. So one of the things I really try and do is when that happens is to not give or take offense, particularly not take offense. It's, to me, it's very important to keep away from that spirit because it can grab you. It's almost like a stronghold. So beware of the spirit of offense. But I think if you look at what's going on, we're going to be talking about tonight, it's just going to keep going up. So it's something we're going to have to grapple with. I want to talk about a few stories in depth today, because I think they're all very important and really connect the dots in some of the things that are going on. In Money and Markets, story number one is, it's morning in America, everything's wonderful. CBO announces deficits are coming down. We have states talking about their surpluses and how the economy is doing well. And it reminds me of a story I've told on the Solari Report before about talking with a reporter who was covering the missing money. There was $4 trillion that went missing from the federal government during the late 90s, early 2000s. And suddenly, we were looking at huge state deficits, and just one day you woke up and suddenly the states were all fine. And I said, you know, what in the world do you think happened? And she said, you know, I think they're just taking the money they're stealing from the federal government and just backdooring it into the states. And I said, it couldn't really have gotten that bad. And then I realized, oh yes, it really could have. So you kind of wonder, as the state's been buying these bonds, you know, whether the money is circumventing and going into all sorts of places through the back door. There's no way to tell. But what's important to understand is where the story breaks down, because of course, where the story breaks down is the fact that we have the middle class basically, disappearing, but literally being squeezed, with many people dropping out of the traditional definitions of what's middle class. So we're watching household incomes fall, household expenses rise, unemployment increasing. Behind the scenes, a new report this week that Obamacare is causing a lot of people to work part-time or not seek employment or drop out of the workforce altogether. A report in from a subscriber that their congressman is being picketed at his house over unemployment and people being angry about the middle class squeeze, but there's no reporting of it on the news. It wouldn't surprise me. A report this morning, Wall Street Journal this morning, more than one in six U.S. men aged 25 to 54 doesn't have a job, partly a symptom of slow economic recovery, and also jobs that are transforming faster than many can adapt. And I think that's very much the story. If you look at the skills needed, they don't match up with the workforce that's looking for the job. And what this all means is that a very important issue in the 2014 elections coming up this year are sort of what's happening to the middle class and government's complicity, which is enormous in this, what's happening and why is it happening? And where you see the crack in the whole story is, in fact, we see the president in the State of the Union address stand up and basically take all the many of the things he's promised that he hasn't delivered on and say, okay, I'm going to make my best effort to get these going. And on many of these issues, I've been stopped by Congress or the bureaucracy. I'm going to use executive orders to continually push these things and sort of go to trench warfare. Well, we now see the Democrats breaking rank. The first one, of course, that I talked about last week was Harry Reid breaking ranks on the trade agreements. Most Americans know that the more trade agreements you have, the more people who lose their job. So the populace is very educated about that. So Harry Reid breaking, as he did in a very public way, indicates enormous stress among the Democratic Party about how they're going to win elections. Don't be surprised to see more and more about voter fraud and issues related to the immigration package, because, of course, the party who can get lots of people moved into citizenship who will vote for them, there's going to be real trench warfare there. But to give you a sense of how scary these elections are going to get, we're watching the story, of course, of Governor Christie in New Jersey, a local strong-arming going on between him and the mayor of Hoboken. Put aside, you know, what that's all really about, including the fact that it's about a real estate project for the Rockefeller Group in Hoboken. But it's also a case study in the way that competition is turning. When competition politically turns to basically use of the criminal justice system to debate how things are done and the merits of things, it turns really ugly. Because the risk of the people involved goes off the charts. Don't be surprised if this election starts to get violent. We've certainly seen a series of announcements of bankers who've been committing suicide or who I would suspect have probably been assassinated. There's no way to tell. Don't be surprised if we see those kinds of stories in the political realm during the election. If you want to go back and look at Sam Smith's Progressive Review website, he used to maintain death lists, watch lists for the Clinton and Bush factions, and I'm sure you can find them up on his website. What is happening in the investigation by the Department of Justice now in the Christie situation? It's impossible to tell what this is really about. But we know that Eric Holder, if you read the Dylan Reed story that I wrote, Dylan Reed in the Aristocracy of Stock Profits, Holder has a long record of implementing highly political agendas through Department of Justice enforcement. The question is, who's pulling the strings? One possibility, of course, is that this relates to the Hillary Clinton campaign. Clinton's been out making sort of early noises for 2016, but it's awful early for something like this to happen. At the same time, it takes a while to get somebody really bogged down in the political process from an investigation or prosecution like this. So, you know, there's no reason not to start early. One wonders if it doesn't have anything to do with the New Jersey senatorial and congressional races in 2014, although former Newark Mayor Booker has pretty much, it looks like it's pretty much locked up the Senate, so I would be surprised if it had anything to do with that. But clearly, it speaks about how ugly and violent the elections are going to get, because in fact, the one place for the middle class to express, or the American people to express this slow burn squeeze on household expenses up, income down, is through the elections. And the Democrats are in real trouble in a lot of areas, or any incumbent is in real trouble in a lot of areas, because the Congress's complicity in all of this is very, very significant. One interesting thing to watch, we've been seeing the Department of Justice settle a series of mortgage settlement cases, J.P. Morgan Chase, Morgan Stanley, lots of money coming into the Department of Justice. will that money make its way back to the people who really hurt, or will it be used as a partisan politics slush fund on the ground? I suspect there's going to be a very ugly story there. I'm reminded, I was in a negotiation and settlement on my litigation, and one of my attorneys looked at one of the lawyers from the Department of Justice, and who was talking about how much money they could make. It was a very Sheriff of Nottingham moment. And the attorney looked at him and got very quizzical and said, but you have to appreciate that that's not the law. The law in this case is this, and you can't do that. That's against the law. And he just looked at her like, honey, where have you been? And that was the period when the word went around Washington. They started to spell the Department of Justice JUST-US, just us. Anyway, whatever's going to happen, Christie, in the best of cases, is going to get weighed down. What's interesting is he's a clear, it's very early, but he's a clear hands-on favorite to get the Republican nomination and could easily, I think, beat any of the Democrats who've been put forward, including Hillary Clinton. And one possibility is Mr. Global just wants to make sure he's got a sufficient control file, so by the time Christie does get to the primaries, it's clear, you know, that he's not going to get anywhere without Mr. Global's support. What you're going to watch in all of this is a case study that no one can get anywhere without Mr. Global basically supporting them. The complexity and the sort of corruption in the system at this point is too great. So to make it through the trench warfare, you have to have clear support from Mr. Global, and you have to be awesome at playing the trench warfare game, because there are plenty of factions who will be allowed to fight things out without Mr. Global interceding. I once did a study on the Salem witch trial to understand what caused it, and what kept it going, and what stopped it. And it was very informative about the use of sort of very high-risk judicial enforcement applied to sort of political squabbling. It's, you know, when political squabbling rolls into the courthouse and starts to create very enormous risk for people. And it was a very interesting case study. And one of the things I learned, one of the things that kept the Salem witch trials going, was that Cotton Mather agreed to allow into the court what's called spectral evidence, which means if I accuse you of projecting your ghost into my bedroom on Saturday night and making me kill my husband, you have to prove that your ghost wasn't in my bedroom, which, as you can imagine, is very difficult to do. So you get into these issues of evidence, which on one hand sound very arcane, but really create these rigged situations. Anyway, so the question was, if this is the case, what could possibly stop these things from happening? And what I discovered was that everyone got so busy going to court and so busy either being accused, defending, prosecuting, being on juries, going and listening, because it was all so fascinating, that literally everyone stopped farming and building the local food supply. And finally someone realized, look, you got to stop all of this. We got to go out and grow more food, otherwise we're going to starve. And as you watch what's happening in terms of enforcement throughout the United States and the use of enforcement as a mechanism to control and engineer either the society or to fight out the politics, what you realize is the amount of money being spent on surveillance, on enforcement, on entrapment, on prosecution has literally spun out of control. And that is an enormous amount of resources that could be used to rebuild the economy or to just rebuild infrastructure, you know, or to be used for thousands of different productive purposes. And I think the question is, when are we going to get to the point where we can find a less expensive way to war politically with each other. Now, why is all of this happening now? Yes, the 2014 elections are coming, but let me tell you about what's coming that puts even bigger money on the table. And let's turn back again to what I talked a lot about in the wrap-up, and I keep talking about it. I'm going to keep talking about it all year. We now have more than 1.2 billion people and growing on smartphones and tablets. What that means is, and you're watching many, many stories about apps being used to localize searches, localize marketing through mobile phones, localizing all sorts of different apps. What that means is, as that process rolls out of being able to identify mobile phone users and aggregate them according to where they are locally, or being able to engineer payment and financial flows through mobile phones, what we're going to start to see is the opportunity to re-engineer place-based government flows. What we're talking about is a pot of money, both small business equity, corporate equity, real estate equity, that is literally in the trillions of dollars. I've said many times before, when I first got to HUD, I did an analysis of the different subsidy programs and estimated that when they had started, about 70 cents on the dollar went to somebody local, and that by the time I got there, 27 cents on the dollar went to someone local. And what that means is, as computers have been bringing down the price of everything, instead the price of government services has been going up, up, up. They've been getting much more paperful. Employment's been going up. And so you have an unbelievably fat flow of money, federal, state, and local, that if you wanted to re-engineer it for what can be done with new technology, the re-engineering potentials are enormous. Now, that is what I was working on with Hamilton Securities in the 90s. It didn't happen, and one of the reasons it didn't happen was, if you re-engineered it then without digital technology, you wouldn't have control. But now that the NSA system has been built out, we have smart meters on everybody's phones, we have all sorts of control through all the digital technology, you can proceed to re-engineer what is literally trillions of dollars of market value of equity, business equity, and real estate, and get the benefit of that with central control. And it is going to be arguably one of the greatest gold rushes in the history of North America. And so that aspect of the market is going to make federal, state, and local politics just more and more fractious, because the power of being the party in place at that time is going to be unprecedented. So expect the 2014 elections to be fractious and the 2016 to be even more fractious. So it's not, as I said, it's not surprising to see what's happening with Christie, but don't be surprised to see those elections to get violent and for the voter fraud stories to get bigger and bigger. Okay, I want to talk a little bit about what's going on in the market. We see the equity markets correcting. I did an equity overview with Chuck Gibson, and it's up in your archives, and I encourage you to listen to it. One of the things we talked about is how overdue the market is for a correction of typically, let me just walk through the numbers, and we described this to you on the overview. Typically, the market has a correction of 5% or more, and which usually happens about every 100 days. And last year, we did get corrections of 5%, but no more. Correction of about 10% or more happens every year, and usually takes about 100 plus days. We haven't gotten one for literally almost 3 years, so we're way overdue for a 10% correction. We're also overdue for a 15% correction. Anywhere from 5 to 20% is pre-bear market. 20% or more is considered a bear market. And so if you look at what's happening in January, we're down, depending on what you're looking at, say 5 to 10%. this is not a big deal. In fact, it's very healthy. It is to be expected. If it starts to be more than 15%, and I figure if we are in for a 15 to 20% correction, it's going to take a couple months. That's natural and healthy. If you look at how much fear talk is going on in the markets, makes no sense. If you look at one of the things that caused the 2008 enormous drop in the markets, it was the amount of fraudulent paper that had been issued in connection with the engineering of what I call the financial coup d'etat. The reality is most of that paper, if not all of that paper, has been extinguished, which is not to say that the financial system is on solid ground. Anything that's centralized is always very, I would say in one sense, is very fragile. But the general system is in a much stronger place. Now, what you're watching is many people in North America, again, the middle class getting squeezed, who feel like the fundamentals are dreadful. And the fundamentals for them are absolutely dreadful. So that's not to say that isn't the case. But it remains to be seen whether or not the equity markets will stay strong. The big question, of course, as Chuck and I discussed in the overview, is corporate earnings. Can corporate earnings continue high? There are numerous ways that corporate earnings can continue high. And one of the ways is both the privatization of the North American government flows, which we've been talking about, but the other is buying up earnings in the emerging markets. We continue to see capital flow out of the emerging markets, and the PEs on North American and developed market equities is much, much higher than in the emerging markets. That's an arbitrage that can be taken advantage of. We see reports last week of the European banks looking to buy banks in the emerging markets. And it's one of the reasons that divergence is probably happening. So keep an eye on the divergence between emerging markets and commodities. Both were down last year, continued down early this year, although some of the commodities look like they might be peaking up, but we'll see. We see lots of stories running around the internet about bankers committing suicide, bankers found dead. A lot of those revolve around places where there's extremely high risk related to both derivatives and litigation, such as in the LIBOR case. All this happening while Yellen gets sworn in as the Fed chairman. I would just warn you not to read too much into those stories in terms of what it means to the systemic global financial system. You have enormous excess capacity in the banks, both here and in Europe. And one of the post-financial coup d'etat issues is how are we going to reduce that capacity now that the banks have delivered on the financial coup d'etat and the paper has been extinguished. You just don't need that capacity. So how Mr. Global sort of re-engineers that back is going to be one of the big issues. It's going to mean tremendous risk for different individuals and people within that system. But again, it is not necessarily going to go to global systemic issues. Another example, I was emailing with one of the subscribers this week as a result, and one of the examples I gave was the fact that if you look at the suicides in the military right now, they're significantly greater. We're seeing as much as 22 to 25 suicides reported a day for vets and members of the U.S. military. It's very extraordinary. And so the stress on the military, I would say, is much worse than the stress on the bankers. But the stress in all of these systems is extraordinary, and it's going to be increasing. Our hero this week is Dr. Zenko Hurricu, a Alabama neurosurgeon, highlighted by CNN, of all people, who was on his way to do brain surgery. He's a neurosurgeon who's on his way to do surgery at the Trinity Medical Center. and got stuck in a snowstorm. Traffic couldn't get through, and so got out in his scrubs and slippers and walked 6 miles. CNN thought that was a very big deal. I will say this, it's the kind of attitude we all are going to need in this environment. We're going to have, as I said, more challenges as we turn and re-engineer as a society, and that's the kind of attitude you're going to need. It's certainly the kind of attitude you're going to want in your neurosurgeon. If the surgeon doesn't get there on time, people can literally die. So kudos to the doctor for showing what needs to be done. Ask Catherine a lot of questions this week. Let me run through them and just read some very interesting comments that we've gotten. I, like most people, have grave concerns over having a cell phone. Currently, I have an iPhone with AT&T. Oh, boy, you've got the worst. and the subscriber says, oh, boy, about the worst combination available. Yes, indeed. I found this article from Chris Martinson's Daily Digest about a possible new black phone. Very exciting. I think some of the things that are going to be happening are lots of different efforts by private individuals and companies to come up with ways of sort of keeping private. And then one of the commentators suggested going back to old technology. Yes, I think that's a very good thing. One of the things I do in terms of appliances, the less digital anything, the better. So, you know, I know people who have 1950 cars so that they can make sure they have no digital chips or anything in the car. We continue. The solution is to take a step backward in technology. Rather than using the internet, depending solely upon encryption, use a one or a node-to-node type BBS system. Messages are encrypted, compressed, and packed, and sent node-to-node along a dial-up network system. See the WWIV BBS network for an example. With current encryption standards for a message and a simple, I'm not sure I can pronounce this, Diff-Hellman key exchange, the NSA would take a long time to decrypt it, seeing that they first would have to target the phone line in question and tap it. Simple 90s technology to get off the grid and stay under the NSA radar. Okay, let me continue. I've listened to Cliff High describe programming his Android phone and disable the tracking devices in it, but realistically, I'm a 60-year-old woman who's not inclined to learn a programming language just so I can have a secure phone. Do you think the BlackBerry is the answer? I have a BlackBerry. It's true, but do I think it's an answer? No, I don't. I think we're going to need a lot more than that. And you see what happened to BlackBerry, and I think there's an absolute connection between what happened to them and trying to make sure they and their networks are brought into the NSA system. And then the continues, but our main providers are Verizon and AT&T, so doesn't that defeat the purpose? Yes, it does. I'm just stuck on this phone thing and what to do. One thing I do is I leave the phone in the car. I only use it for what's absolutely necessary, and I really just use it as a phone. I don't use it as a smartphone. But that means, of course, I have to grapple with what's going on my laptop. Thanks. I'm sure you'll come up with a creative solution. I think we're all going to be grappling with how we maintain privacy. And to a certain extent, I gave up on privacy a long time ago and just decided I was going to live my life and be impeccable about being compliant with the law and regulations to the extent possible, but simply just live my life. Next question. You commented that the emerging markets were greatly undervalued and that we may have a crash up in the Western markets. In your opinion, should we focus on the Western markets for now? Right now, everything's falling. So I would, I wouldn't necessarily focus on any particular market other than to track it. I think that at some point, we're going to get a bottom in the emerging markets. And at that point, the income levels are so greatly undervalued relative to the Western market that what my expectation is that's going to be extraordinary time to shift investment into the emerging markets. And again, I think some of the divergence is an opportunity for the Western companies to pick things up cheaply, and we're going to be watching that happen. So, but of course, when something's falling, you don't want to buy in during that period. So you have to, we have to see where it shakes out. While I think the long-term fundamentals on the emerging markets are very, very good, I don't underestimate the ability of the markets that are this centralized and this managed to get into a panic and for, you know, some crazy things to happen. So I think you want to be careful and wait, but I do think there's going to be very great opportunities. The place I would focus on the market is not in looking at necessarily North America versus emerging. I would be focused, or developed markets versus emerging, I would be focused on watching the gapping between what I call global 2.0 and 3.0. It's all described in the wrap-up, because I think that's where the divergence is going to be very powerful, and the real opportunities are going to be to find a way to invest early in those aspects of 3.0 that you think really are, have a fundamental economic purpose, as opposed to just believing building the police state, which I think is clearly part of 3.0. But I think watching the divergences between these different markets and between the 2.0 and 3.0 is going to be a very interesting activity, and one I'm going to spend a lot of time on in 2014. Next question. The Pope asked his Vatican bankers to meet with him so they can get together and be closer to Jesus. Shortly after meeting with the Pope fires 11 of the Vatican bankers. Would you and Dr. Farrell speculate on this event? I talked about it a little. I've talked about this a little bit with Dr. Farrell. I think it's clear that we see a Pope re-engineering the entire Vatican hierarchy, and it has very significant implications for the global model. So we speculated about it a little bit, but I think we're going to have to see how things evolve before we have any idea what's really happening. Please comment on the January 28th op-ed piece in the New York Times re a new book arguing that worsening inequality is an inevitable outcome of free market capitalism. That is complete and utter bunk. I'm a great believer that markets permit extraordinary optimization in the economic process. If we had had free market capitalism, new technology would have advantaged small business against big corporations, and things would have turned out completely different. We haven't had free market capitalism. We've had, you know, a process that engineered centralization using covert and overt violence. It is the opposite of free market capitalism. Be very aware, or be very wary of anybody who argues that inequality is the result of free market capitalism, because that will be used as an argument to shut off the ability of entrepreneurs and small businesses to use free market capitalism to build family and private equity. That only serves the interests of centralization. So let me just continue reading the comment. Contending that capitalism inherent dynamic propels powerful forces that threaten democratic societies, various remedies are suggested by different eminent economists, all seeming to be unlikely. The piece ends with, quote, his prognosis is extremely bleak. Without what he acknowledges as a politically unrealistic global wealth tax, he sees the United States and the developed world on a path to a degree of inequality that will reach levels likely to cause severe social disruption. I agree with that. That is the trajectory that we're currently on. But that's the trajectory we've been on very clearly since 1994. Again, if you haven't watched the video, Sir James Goldsmith explaining where this is going and the sort of the WTO move, I would encourage you to do it. Can we imagine alternative choices? I really fear that his proposal, global wealth tax, with some presumed more equal distribution and force through more automation, would be paradoxically a way to just control everyone and not eliminate any of the covert transfer of wealth. You got it. That's exactly right. I think the more, one thing we can all do is the more we can bring transparency to what is happening and why, the more it can diffuse the power of central control. But I do think it's contingent on all of us to do everything we can to improve our learning speeds and adapt, because these kinds of things always happen when new technology is upon us. And the more we can diffuse and disperse the benefits of that new technology, the better. Next question. Regarding the depression of the spot price of gold, would it be a means of repatriating Yamashita's gold back to the Chinese? That is, we cannot give you your gold, but we will depress the price while you accumulate the gold. That is until there is no gold left and we go to war. Somewhat simplified. Looking for your comment. Another question on gold that I'll, or let me read all the comments on gold and then I'll answer. As Dr. Fair would say, now for wild speculation regarding gold in China. We know that China is the largest producer and they are the largest buyer. Could it be that their advances in space technologies brought them into, as Plan GE's CEO comment, China has a respectable economic system. Has it brought them into trade-off planet for resources, gold, and human resources? We know that they have built mega unoccupied cities to move their citizens into urban settings as Earth, a manufacturing slave site for the local solar system plus area. Interested in your comment. Dear Catherine, did the powers that be simply allow the price of gold to rise above 1900 an ounce when gold hit its peak, or were market forces so strong that they couldn't hold the price down a lot lower? Do you think that the powers that be can manage the slow burn economy with a great degree of certainty? Or is it still possible that everything could implode and totally spin out of control? The reality is we could spend the rest of our lives doing several things, trying to figure out what the real statistics are in terms of the gold inventory available on planet Earth. I've tried several times to get to the bottom of what is the existing inventory, and it is impossible to tell the truth. And part of it is because there's so much gold on the covert side that's involved in these various pools that have been, that were sort of bought up and controlled or manipulated or stashed away at the end of World War II. So the post-World War II gold figures are very hard to determine. And I don't know yet of a reliable way to determine them. So that's number one. But clearly, if you read the article that I published on the gold ETF GLD, it's called Precious Metals Puzzle Palace. You can pick it up on a search or link from the article section of our website. GLD was clearly used as a vehicle to stockpile gold. Now, the question was that stockpiling for the purpose of, stockpiling gold to make a trade or make an investment or, you know, return gold to the Far East? Who knows? But it could have been that. Was it instead done to suppress the price? Who knows? My guess is that there are serious shortages globally in the gold inventories, and that's part of what we're seeing happen now in terms of bringing gold in. Think of this as, as I've said before, confiscation by market means. But the answers to all of your good questions at the end of the day is we don't know, and that's part of what we have to do. We have to navigate an environment where the swap of the GLD gold out into the Far East is part of some picture we can't see. It's part of a transaction or a fundamental shift that we can't see. Or it's simply part of the market manipulation. But again, as I've said before, I think gold is in a primary trend up, but it hasn't been proved out yet. And we need to see that proved in terms of real price. I would say this, the pressure on the leadership globally to convert to an equity model is extreme. And I think there's no way that they're going to encourage or permit the entire global population to put all their money in a metal that sits in a vault as opposed to having it used in productive activities. And so the politics of forcing a system or developing a system that is trustworthy and attractive to investors, that's the challenge that's upon us. So I would be aware to spend too much time trying to figure out the gold story, because at the end of the day, it's impossible to get statistics that I think are reliable. Not to say I don't commend the people who try. I really appreciate their doing this. And let's go to the movies. Our movie this week is The Holcroft Covenant. I'm a great Robert Ludlum fan, and The Holcroft Covenant is based on his novel about the endowment created from Nazi funds. I think a lot of monies, the Nazi monies, were laundered out. It's one of the things that Dr. Farrell and I talk about in the interview this week. I think the Nazi story is a very, very useful story for understanding the fact that there's a metastructure in place, and these different groups come together in governments or subsidiaries, and then things change over time. And one of the things I will say about the governance structure on planet Earth, they compost everything. And the reorganization and shifting of Nazi resources after the war is a great case study in understanding the metastructure, and of course seeing the seeds of what I call the breakaway civilization, because a lot of it goes back to sort of how things split up and were organized at the end of World War II. Another movie that I recommend, if you really want to see that metastructure in sort of a blunt way, is a movie that the East German socialists made after World War II called The Council of the Gods. It's quite blunt in its description. We will post tonight the interview with Dr. Farrell. It's always a pleasure to talk with him. He's done tremendous research on the history of the Nazis and their secret technology and what happened to those resources after the war. And I've posted a list at the interview of all of his different books. And if that's a case study that interests you, I would really encourage you to look at it. So that's it for today, February 6th, 2014. Coming up, a very important one next week, Franklin Sanders back, not to talk about precious metals, but jailhouse ministry. This is a topic that I have a great deal of experience and knowledge with, and Franklin's coming at it from another standpoint as a reverend, Episcopal reverend, who's preaching the gospel and trying to help people rebuild their lives. So we're going to be talking about his jailhouse ministry and what that has to do with building local economies in North America. And then February 20th, I will have Richard Dolan, who's just published a new and absolutely outstanding book called UFOs for the 21st Century Mind. That's one I'm really looking forward to, and I'm going to give that book a big Solari star. If you want to understand our world today, you absolutely want to get that book, UFOs for the 21st Century Mind. So until next week with Franklin on February 13th, please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. Ladies and gentlemen, good night and good luck.